From Reclaim the Media in Seattle and the Northwest Community Radio Network, it's Listen Up Northwest. Each week we bring you a roundup of stories from communities throughout our region. I'm your host, Yuko Kadama. Gas prices are on the rise, and so is the number of people seeking greener means of transportation. More people have been crossing town on two wheels, whether commuting, exercising, or just having fun. Today, we consider bicycling in the Northwest and the challenges of cycle safety in the midst of our car culture. First, an audio diary from someone new to bicycle commuting. We listen to some entries from her first 2 weeks. In Seattle, a critical mass bike ride ends in a violent clash between motorists and cyclists. We revisit media coverage of that event and ask some participants to reflect on what took place. And an Oregon mom offers advice on training kids and bike safety before their feet can even reach the pedals. All this and more coming up on this week's edition of Listen Up Northwest. With a citywide network of bike routes, lanes, dedicated bridge access, and bike racks, Portland, Oregon enjoys a reputation as a cycle-friendly city. We begin the show with an audio diary from a bicycle commuting newbie. Julie Sabatier in Portland started pedaling to work this summer. She shares some of her experiences from the first 2 weeks of riding.
I've had the same bicycle for 10 years now, and I've never been what you would call a serious rider. I don't ride in the rainy Oregon winters, for example. But since it started costing me more than $50 to gas up my car, I've been relying on my human-powered vehicle more and more. This month, I decided it was time to try commuting to work by bike. To me, it felt like a pretty major undertaking. The 6.5-mile ride takes me about 40 minutes, and it saves me roughly $2 a day since I'm not buying gas for the commute. Fortunately, the radio station where I work has a shower available, because I'm completely unpresentable when I arrive. I kept an audio diary of my commute for the first 2 weeks. On the very first day, I discovered a slow leak in my front tire. All the area bike shops appeared to be closed, but I was able to patch my tire at my coworker Emily's house, with some assistance from her husband, Colin.
Okay. Let's see if we can figure out where this leak is coming from.
We do have a little swimming pool over there we can use if we don't find it.
Okay, so we found it in the pool. We found the leak, and it's really tiny. So that does make it easy to patch, doesn't it?
Yeah.
As long as I don't forget where it is. It's right there.
There's some sandpaper.
Okay. Let's see. Opening up the patch here. It's all sticky. Okay. Well, thanks.
You bet.
This is day two, and I'm officially the slowest biker on the road. I get passed by everyone. I get passed by commuters in their khaki pants and their work shirts who aren't even breaking a sweat. I get passed by fat guys in t-shirts with their butt cracks hanging out. You know, of course I get passed by the guys with their spandex and their big calves. But I also get passed by people who are towing their children behind in those little little children cabs that you can pull your kids in on your bike. So yeah, I'm pretty slow. I just biked home, and I'm talking to the microphone. I'm doing my radio diary. Go away. All right, close the door. So, it's Thursday of the fourth day, and I have to say, it does seem to be getting a little bit easier in that I don't feel like I'm going to keel over and die right now. And I also don't feel like I'm going to destroy anything in my path to food either, which I have felt in past days. It could be because I ate a lot of starch today. Maybe starch is the answer. I am still very sweaty, and my face looks like a red tomato.
It's Friday of the first week, and I went out last night, and I really, really don't feel like biking. I didn't get enough sleep, and I'm a little cranky, but it's a beautiful day outside, and... So I'm inspired. I think I'm going to do it. Okay, so here I am in the parking garage at work. I didn't want to ride this morning, but I did, and I'm so glad because I feel awesome. It's Wednesday, week two, and I'm definitely a little bit faster. I just shaved about 5 minutes off my trip, and I passed someone on the way here. I know it's not a race, but it was exciting.
Those were portions of Julie Sabatier's audio diary of cycling to work. She produces Destination DIY in Portland, Oregon. Julie started her bicycle commutes as an adult, but cycling advocate Tracy Harding wants her two kids to get an earlier start. She talks about teaching them bicycle safety with Wes Brain of KSKQ in Ashland, Oregon. This is an excerpt from a longer interview.
Well, tell us about the transportation mode of using bicycles.
Well, I just enjoy the bicycle so much more than the car. For me and my two kids, we have made our bikes our habit, and we think long and hard before we drive anywhere.
Your bike has hooked up a trailer with it, is that right?
Right. I used to have my kids in the trailer. Now they're both on their own bikes, and the trailer's for when we have too much to carry on our bikes.
Before they could ride a bike, they were riding a bike, or at least they were being pulled by your trailer.
Right. They both started in the little seat on my rear fender, and then as they got bigger, moved to the trailer. And I always just talked to them about what was happening while we were on our bikes. If something unusual would happen, I would say, now, what just happened was that that car did this and didn't see me or whatever. So I was always making sure that they were paying attention and not just sitting back there singing songs, which was nice too, but I knew that my goal was to get them on their own two wheels safely. So conversations were important to improving their safety. And then as they got on their own two wheels, I would stop riding if something happened to make sure that I had their eye contact and their full attention to explain the situation. Children have the unfortunate disadvantage of never having driven a car, so all these things don't make as much sense to them as they do to folks who have driven cars. And the unfortunate difference between riding your bike and walking is that when you're riding your bike, you're really conscious of your safety all the time. And when you're walking, you can space out and think about whatever you want until you get to the crosswalk. But on the bike, you really have to be guarding yourself all the time.
Trace, would you tell us about your children? How old are they? And a little bit about each of them.
Sure. Well, Frank's 11 and Stella's almost 8. And Frank's now getting a little more advanced in his biking. I can let him ride around town on his own. He lets me know what his route will be, and then he calls me when he gets there. So that's pretty important and powerful to him. And last year, Frank built his own bike with the help of an adult, and that was exciting. Got a frame, got the parts, and built the whole bike.
You're talking about an 11-year-old, right?
Yeah. And Stella still needs an escort and doesn't ride alone yet, and still is improving her safety all the time.
That was Tracy Harding, interviewed by Wes Brain of KSKQ Low Power FM in Ashland, Oregon. For many riders, cycling is more than getting to work or taking a nice ride in a park. It's about a worldwide movement for people-powered transportation and a fight for their rights to the road. Many bicycle activists participate in monthly critical mass events in which cyclists ride en masse through city streets, drawing attention to their presence and to safety concerns facing urban cyclists. One Friday this summer, a critical mass ride in Seattle turned ugly as cyclists clashed with the driver of a car blocked in by the passing bicycles. After an exchange of heated words, the driver lost patience, drove his car into the cyclists, and drove off, leaving injured cyclists and wrecked bicycles behind. Several bikers pursued the driver, attacking him and damaging his car before police arrived at the scene. Local media coverage of the event, which tended to portray the cyclists involved as unrepentant anti-car thugs and the driver as the primary victim, left many wondering who had really done what and to whom.
But witnesses say they saw about a dozen cyclists surround a white Subaru.
But some thought the demonstrators took their message way too far.
The rest of us who are standing here, you know, in our cars or sitting, and we can't go anywhere because we're all horrified. Scared that if we go around, then maybe they're going to jump on our car too.
But he said rage quickly turned into fear and panic as he was surrounded by the cyclist who battered his car, smashed his windows, and tore a mirror from the driver's side of his 1998 white Subaru Impreza.
Bicyclists felt unfairly maligned by the press, and the incident raised broader questions of who has the right to the road, what contributes to road rage between cyclists and drivers, and did media coverage contribute to or distract from greater understanding? Tara Hayes of KBCS contributes the story, which first aired a week after the incident.
When violence erupted between critical mass cyclists and a motorist blocked by their passing, no one came out ahead. Critical mass is a decentralized, informal group of cyclists that take to Seattle roads once a month, riding en masse. At the event, bikes and car were damaged in the confrontation. Several bicycle riders and the driver of the car were injured. The question of blame played out in the media, leaving many in the bicycle community feeling misrepresented. Davey Oyle is a Seattle-based bicycle advocate. He's been on many critical mass rides in the past. He says the event and its participants are not violent. He sees cyclists more often on the receiving end of angry drivers.
We've always had some senseless aggression directed towards cyclists, but I do believe that we're seeing more and more of this. There's an increasing number of cyclists on the road. I think that's confusing a lot of other road users. And I think that people's drives are becoming less and less pleasant. And a cyclist is a visible target.
Many cyclists who attended the event feel that the media portrayed the conflict inaccurately. Ezra prefers we not use her last name. She was part of the critical mass ride and witnessed firsthand the conflict between the car's driver and the bicyclists.
They ignored the fact that the driver said, "F*** this," and intentionally drove into living beings in front of him. And then he was zooming down the street with a guy on top of the car holding for, you know, dear life. And this was all before any of the bikers even touched this car. After being a first-hand witness, and I'm seeing the news, and it's totally, like, completely different, and I thought I was going crazy.
Larry Hildes is a lawyer for David Maxwell, one of the two cyclists arrested at the incident. Hildes says the media reaction to the event failed to look at what really happened.
It started out sounding like a witch hunt against critical mass, as if critical mass was this vicious mob riding out of control and discrediting bikers and so on, completely ignoring what critical mass actually is and completely ignoring what really happened at the scene, which was that a motorist didn't feel like waiting for a minute or two for the ride to go by and decided to take out the fact that he was late for his dinner reservation on a demonstration and could have killed people.
Bob Anderton, a Seattle lawyer who represents injured bicyclists and a bicycle rider himself, sees more people riding and more people getting hurt. He thinks improved bicycle infrastructure, like bike boxes that show where cars and bikes can stop at intersections, would reduce the number of accidents.
I am seeing more people who are being injured on their bikes. But I attribute that to negligence, not to intentional violence. I think there's a fundamental difference between being in a car where you're in your own space. You can't help but be selfish because you can control your sound and your temperature and you got a cage around you. You're protected. And it's completely the opposite when you're on a bike where you're constantly on guard that somebody could open a door or come out of an alley or somehow get you. You've got just a completely different mindset. It's ripe for clash.
Davey Oyle agrees that the city's traffic layout contributes to the conflicts.
I think that most of it has to do with how our streets are built and how our cities are built. I think most of that has to do with the fact that we don't live in an infrastructure that's built for people. We live in infrastructure that's built for cars.
Anderton also wishes the media would focus on solutions in their coverage rather than sensationalize the violence that took place.
What I would like to see is the focus on the infrastructure being made safer for bicyclists, which I think could avoid the kind of flared tempers like this.
Sean Arducci is the chair of the Seattle Bicycle Advisory Board. He thinks the incident was a case of the worst, on both sides. But he does hear complaints from the community. Many cyclists feel that law enforcement is punitive and doesn't focus on protecting them. In fact, some critical mass riders, like Ezra, would be happy for more police presence.
And I believe this would be a great idea and it would work for the benefit of the bikers, because then at least the police will see critical mass riders are not all about, you know, thugs or mobs or, and some people even said terrorists.
Both cyclists and motorists agree they'll have to share the road. And with rising gas prices and the threat of global warming, there will be more cyclists on the streets. One hopes that municipalities, drivers, and cyclists can come together to create better, safer traffic, and that the media can refrain from making things worse.
That was Tara Hayes of Seattle's KBCS One World Report. Like a number of cities in our region, Vancouver, British Columbia has been working to make its streets more bike-friendly, including designating a network of bike routes around the city. But an international comparison shows that there's much more our cities can do to promote safe cycling. Recently, Rutgers professor John Pooker visited Vancouver to talk about public policy and cycling safety in North America and beyond. His talk was recorded by Red Eye Radio of CFRO in Vancouver, British Columbia.
One of the key approaches that these German, Dutch, and Danish cities take to making cycling possible for everyone is by making it safe. It's absolutely key. If you do surveys of the general population and you ask them, why don't you cycle? The number one reason by far is the perception that cycling is unsafe. This is particularly true among the elderly, among the parents of children, among women. And what they most want, when you ask them, what would most make you cycle? The answer, about 80% of the cases, is give us separated facilities. Help us get away some degree of protection from the motor vehicle traffic, give us good parking facilities, connect it to public transportation, give us good sort of interchanges with public transportation, but above all, give us safe places to cycle. So anyway, increasing the safety of cycling and increasing the perceived safety of cycling is absolutely crucial in cycling policies. Traffic safety, cycling safety here in Canada, is almost three times greater than it is in the United States, but you could do a lot better. Cycling could be at least twice as safe as it is now. Now, this is a rather controversial topic, the next one, because I know here in British Columbia there is a helmet law, and everyone is required to wear a helmet when cycling. And I personally, when I cycle in New Jersey or anywhere in the United States, I also wear a helmet. But I can tell you the Dutch don't wear helmets, not even the children. The Danes don't wear helmets, and a very, very small percentage, 5 or 10%, even Germans wear helmets. So they have much higher degrees of safety in those countries without wearing helmets. So at least in those countries, the key to greater cycling safety does not appear to be the helmets, but rather much, much safer cycling facilities. Another, I think, interesting statistic here. This was a city, Münster, Germany. It's the most cycling-oriented city in all of Germany, about a third of all trips by bike. But they have the most extensive and most separate cycling facilities of any German city. And look at the result here. One cycling injury per roughly 600,000 trips. Not a fatality, an injury. One injury per 600,000 bike trips. Given that statistic, you can understand why everyone in Münster perceives cycling as being totally safe. And perhaps because of that reason, no one wears a helmet. But again, totally aside from your views on helmets, I just think it's astounding how safe you can make cycling. Cycling can be extremely safe if you do the right things. Moreover, It turns out, a colleague of mine, Peter Jacobson in California, has done, and a number of people as well, Terry Rutter at Oxford University, have done studies, and they've shown that as cycling levels increase, cycling becomes safer and safer. As cycling levels decrease, cycling becomes less and less safe. So that if we succeed here, for example, in metropolitan Vancouver, to reach this goal of, I think it's 5% trips by bike, currently we're about 2%, it's almost inevitable that cycling will become safer. There are two reasons for this. I'm still oversimplifying here, but one reason is the more people who are cycling, the higher the likelihood that a motorist will at some time or other also have been on a bike and be more sensitive to the needs of cyclists and drive with more consideration and care vis-a-vis cyclists. The other reason is, as more and more people cycle, you have more demand and also supply of the necessary cycling facilities, whether that be separate bike paths, bike lanes, bike parking, and so forth. But anyway, this is a very, very important concept, I think, because those of us who are advocating more cycling often get criticized by saying, well, you're, on the one hand, you're showing us a safety problem here. There's a relatively high traffic fatality rate among cyclists, and yet you're advocating more cycling. What are you really advocating? But the point is, if we succeed in raising the cycling mode share, we're inevitably going to reduce the fatality rate and make cycling safer overall. Now, what did these European cities do to promote cycling and make it safer? They completely reversed their public policies in the 1970s. There had been a huge decline in cycling. Many of you probably assume, well, cycling's been booming in Europe forever and forever and forever. It's just not true. If you look at the 1950s, 1960s, huge declines in cycling, 70%, 80%, in some countries even 90% declines in cycling. Why? Because of the increase in car ownership, increase in car use, expansion of roadways, and really nothing being done to facilitate walking or cycling, a neglect of the public transit, no efforts to integrate these various green modes of transportation. Then what happened in the 1970s in every single one of these countries, at the city level, at the state level, and at the national level, a complete turnaround of policies, increasing year by year by year by year, more and more auto restraint policies, restrictions of car parking, traffic calming of residential neighborhoods, car-free zones, more and more of them, and bigger areas of the car-free zones. At the same time, so those are the stick policies, the auto restraint policies. On the other hand, vastly improving public transportation systems, bikeway systems, pedestrian systems, and in particular in terms of cycleways, we have, again, many of you think, well, the Netherlands was always perfect for bicycling. Not true. They had a tripling in their bikeway network between the 1970s and the 1990s. In Germany also, they tripled the kilometers of their bikeway network and vastly improved it year by year. Even now, they are not sitting on their laurels. Every single year in every single German city I know, in every Dutch city, in every Danish city, they're constantly trying to figure out how can we make these facilities better. And as a result of doing this, by the way, they dramatically increased levels of cycling. These are large cities. Munich, they more than doubled the mode share of cycling. More than doubled in Nuremberg. They doubled it in Cologne and so forth. So Munich is probably just about the same sort of population size, metropolitan area, as Vancouver. I mean, imagine you're trying to achieve a goal of going from 2% to 5%, and look what they did in Munich. They went from 6% to 13%. There's this sort of a false perception that car-free zones are somehow going to be harmful to business. In every single case I know about in these three countries, these car-free zones are thriving. They're booming economically, and more merchants want to be part of them. One of the reasons that the Danes, the Germans, and the Dutch cycle so much, and also walk and take transit so much, is because it costs a lot more but to fill up with gasoline. And it's about twice as much as it costs here in Canada. These prices have all increased, as you know, in the last year. And we're paying even less in the United States. Now imagine, if you were paying, say, $2, $3, $4 a liter for gasoline, I'll bet you'd think twice about getting in that car. I mean, every single one of us is self-centered to some extent. We're going to do things that are in our own self-interest. And let me tell you, if you make the cost of parking your car, buying your car, running your car, and so forth, very expensive, you're certainly going to encourage more walking, cycling, and transit use as well. So that certainly is another key. And I think Americans, as well as Canadians, are terrified somehow politically of restricting car use, of imposing higher taxes on car use. I mean, in every American state, it's like, as you know, two of the three major presidential candidates now want to eliminate the tax on gasoline altogether to get more votes. So it's a very difficult political thing to do, but it's certainly, in both the UK and in Germany and in some of these other countries as well, they explicitly imposed an annual increase in the gasoline tax. They called it the environmental surcharge every single year. So there was a regular increase in the tax on gasoline so that, and people could predict this. They would, well, in 10 years, gasoline is going to be more and more and more expensive, and they could then learn how to ride a bike or walk more, buy better walking shoes. And almost all the difference, by the way, in the price of gasoline is due to taxation. It's not because of differences in the base price of petroleum. It's because these countries have made the explicit policy decision of making gasoline more expensive, and by doing that, discouraging car use and encouraging walking, cycling, and transit, and using the humongous revenues from that to help finance those facilities. So it's sort of a doubly beneficial impact. Well, what are the other things that these countries do to encourage more cycling and making it safer? Making all roads more bikeable, fixing up the potholes, fixing up the drain grates, wider curb lanes, and so forth and so on. Traffic calming of residential neighborhoods, more cycling facilities and better cycling facilities, integration of cycling with public transport, restrictions especially in central areas and in residential neighborhoods of car use. Traffic education is key. Traffic regulations and enforcement, absolutely key. Mixed-use zoning and improved urban design. Why is that important? Because if you have relatively compact development with mixed uses, you're going to have shorter trip distances, getting from home to work, to school, to shopping, and so forth. So it's really, really key to have effective land use planning that ensures mixed-use development and compact development.
That was John Pooker, professor of public policy at Rutgers University, recorded by Red Eye Radio on CFRO in Vancouver, BC. You're listening to the Portland Bicycle Ensemble, whose instruments are amplified bicycles. Northwest is produced by Reclaim the Media at the studios of KBCS for the Northwest Community Radio Network. Find out more at nwcommunityradio.org. Thanks to contributors Wes Brain, Tara Hayes, Julie Sabatier, and Red Eye Radio. Music by Northwest artists DJ B-Girl, Asia West and the Macrosoft, and Jason Leonard. Special thanks to Joaquin Wee, Antonio DeLeo, Seattle Times, and King 5. And thank you for listening to and supporting your community radio station. For Listen Up Northwest, this is Yuko Kadama.